Right, let's get started this morning. So, I want to conclude with ESA today and move on to sorting functions. And there are first a few small items that I need to explain about the proof language ESA. First, there's something that is quite useful occasionally, local lemmas. If in the middle of a proof you want to have a local lemma that has its own assumptions and has its own local variables, then you can write it like this. It's just a normal have, but then you can also add if, and then you have some assumptions that have some name, and for x1 to xn means you're proving this for fixed but arbitrary values of x1 to xn, which means in the end you're proving it for all x1 to xn, but they will stay fixed during that proof. And so if you finish that proof, then what you get in the end is this implication from the assumptions. It implies the conclusion B, but where all the xi that you have quantified over here are now replaced by question mark variables, meaning they are now completely generalized, and you can use the implication here with arbitrary values for the xi. So that's occasionally convenient. And finally, a word about the correspondence between the ESA proof state that you see in the lower of the two windows and the ESA text, because there is a correspondence. If in your ESA text you write proof and then some proof method like induction, what will happen in the lower window? You will see that this application of the proof method to your current proof state generates one or more new proof states, new sub-goals, and those are the ones that you will see in the lower window. So these, the ones that you see in the output window, are the sub-goals generated by the proof method. And then you can see exactly what you need to prove, except that the system may use its own names for the local variables. And how do you prove each sub-goal? Well, if you have this situation, then you, in principle, you have to fix those variables, except that some of them may have already been fixed in the context, so you only have to fix the new ones that weren't fixed further up. And you can assume all the things on the left. Well, of course, some of them you may have assumed already, so you just have to assume the new things that were generated by this proof method. So that means, for example, if you're in induction, in an induction step, you can assume one more thing or two more things. And then eventually you have to show the B. So the proof state shows you precisely what your current assumptions are, what you have to prove. And that is sometimes useful if you're confused about what some proof method did. What exactly did the induction do? Then you can look at the output window and it'll show you what are all the assumptions that you now have at your disposal and what is the conclusion that you have to prove. So the output window can sometimes give you, the proof state window can sometimes give you a confirm or let you check that what you think you have to prove is really what you have. And of course, there might be multiple subgoals, and therefore you'd have to prove multiple such blocks separated by next. Now, the most important proof method next to these chains of equations and inequations will be proofs by cases analysis and by induction. And this is the main part of the first half of this morning. I'll introduce you to how to do that in ESA. So let's start right away with a demo, and first for a demo for proof by cases. Okay. Oh, I hate that. So no, okay.
So which one of them is it? No, not that one. Or maybe this one. That's the one. But now where's this one? Okay. So this is a proof text that you can see down there. Oops. That is a proof by case analysis, and this is the theorem that we're trying to prove, that the length of the tail of a list is the length of the list minus one, and this works because we are on natural numbers, so the length of the list is a natural number, minus one on natural numbers, if it's already zero, then you stay at zero, and the same with the length, that corresponds the length, the same with tail. The tail of the empty list is defined to be the empty list. So that's just the same correspondence with the cutoff subtraction. So how do we prove this? Well, simply by a case analysis on the axis. So what does axis look like? And there are two cases. So you say proof by cases, axis, and then you have two possibilities. Axis could be empty, and then the thesis, meaning this whole equation, follows just by simplification. And otherwise, if axis is non-empty, it means there must be y and y's, and axis must be of this form. So this is what the corresponding assumption is, that y's is of this form for arbitrary but fixed. X's is of this form here for arbitrary but fixed y and y's. And then again, you can prove the thesis by simplification. Well, just substitute this value for the x's. The tail of it is just y's. So you get length of y's on the left-hand side. What do we get on the right-hand side? Length of this one is length of y's plus one, minus one is just length of y's again. So everything works out. And the important point is really that if you explicitly start a proof by cases and then you mention some data type value here, then you are allowed to, depending on what data type it is, you're allowed to enumerate all the different forms the constructor can take. So here is the form that the thing that you're doing the case analysis on is the empty list. It's the cons and whatever other constructors there may be for that data type. So you get as many cases as you have constructors for the data type that builds this the type of that. In this case, it's a variable, but it could just be a big expression. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a variable. So that's the explicit form. Questions about that one, what those things mean? Then there is a somewhat shorter one, and that uses a new idiom. And that's down here. So let's see if we can get both on the screen. Yeah, up. It's almost impossible to really. No. Finally. So that was the explicit construction, where you explicitly say what you're assuming and the new variables that occur in those assumptions. Down here, let's ignore for a moment this line. Down here, we have, and let's get rid of all these things here. We'll put them back in a moment, but at the moment they just confuse the structure.
So
there's one correspondence between that proof and that proof, and you can see this proof somehow is shorter. You don't have to write as much. So what we're using here, we're using an idiom. It's the same proof method, but now instead of saying assume something, we just say case nil, and the system will automatically say, okay, in the proof by case analysis, there are all these cases that have the same name as the constructors of the data type that you're doing the analysis on. And in each case, the system will know what the right assumptions are. So if you say case nil, it implicitly does exactly that, what you have here. And if you say case cons with two variable names, then the system will implicitly arrange for exactly that. And this looks like there's not much to choose between the two. This is just hardly longer than this one. But if you have bigger proofs with more cases, then it actually this idiom is the nicer and more easier to write one. Now, what exactly does that mean? It means really that when you write this line, the system will introduce this assumption here, and in fact, it will give this assumption here. In this case, we didn't need a name, we just wrote thus, and then the assumption was piped into this proof. But in case we wanted to give it a name, the name would actually be the name of that constructor. And similarly down here, we don't use the name, but implicitly the system introduces this assumption and gives it that name here. And the variables here, you don't have to give them, but if you don't give them, then the system will choose its own variable names and then you cannot refer to them. So in this proof here, these variable names y and ys are overkill because you're never referring to them. So you could in fact just say case cons. But if it's a larger proof, then you may have to refer to those variable names, and then you need to state them by hand. So those are the two forms of the case distinction. And so let's look at this. Why can't I do this? Yeah, and now it works. Okay, so now let's look at this in a more general form. So you have a data type T, and it's defined by some list of constructors C1 up to blah blah. Then if you do a proof by cases on some term, it doesn't have to be a variable, and that term is of this type T, what happens? You are now allowed to write case, and then one of the constructors, in this case constructor C1, and some variables, and the variables will be in one-to-one correspondence with the arguments of the constructor. So you have to have, well, you have to have, at you can have at most as many variables here as this constructor C1 takes arguments. And then in the proof that follows that case up to the next down here, you can use those variables freely. And what does that stand for? That stands for you fix those variables, you assume that the term that you're doing the analysis on is of this form here, the constructor I. Well, here it was just constructor 1, but in general it could be one of these constructors here. That the term is of this form here, and you additionally, or the system additionally, gives this assumption a name, and the name is exactly the name of that constructor. And then you can refer inside the proof, you can refer not just to the XI, but you can also refer to the CI, and that will stand for this equality here. And of course, what you have to prove in this case is still the same thesis as before, because you're just doing a case analysis, but the thing that you're proving stays unchanged. Now, the editor and the system actually give you a little bit of help in laying out those proofs. Let's go back. It doesn't go back anymore. Right. That's something weird. Which one is it? This one? Or this one? This one. Now let's Well, actually, we don't need to do that. Just let's leave that. What you can see here, when you look at this line, there's the blue marker on the right, on the left, which says the system has some information for you. And how do we look at this information? We can, well, one way is somehow you can hover over this. This never quite works for me. And then what you see is the system provides an outline of the different cases, and you can just, by clicking on it, paste that outline into your proof. So now I've just, it's put that instead of, well, I mean, it's inserted it in front of the existing proof. And now here you have a proof skeleton that works in principle, except that there are the actual proof is not there. There's a sorry there. And then you can start from that. You can, for example, say, oh, I don't need those variable names, and can just remove them and stuff like that, and fill in the rest of the proof. So whenever you do proof by cases, the system will give you an outline of what the different cases are, and then it's quite helpful to use that so you don't have to type it. Yeah. Now, case analysis, the first step, more interesting, is induction. And so let's right away look at some examples of structural induction for the natural numbers. No. And the first proof is similar to what we saw with the case analysis. So what are we trying to prove? We're trying to prove that the sigma is the summation operator, and it takes here, in this case, as an argument, just a set. So it sums up all the elements of the set, and the set has the elements from 0 up to n, and n is a natural number. And the claim here is that this sum is equal to n times n plus 1 div 2. And in this proof, we explicitly give a name to this statement. We call that P of n. So we are using this pattern matching facility that we saw last time. So this P is defined by pattern matching to be this formula here, depending on n. And then you say, okay, I want to do an induction on n. And now you can just say, we show P of 0 by simp. And then essentially you are yourself taking that statement, and instead of substituting 0 for n everywhere, you just use this abbreviation that you've created up there, and you apply it to 0. And then if you look at the formula, if you were to look at the formula, you would exactly that see that formula, but with n everywhere replaced by 0. And then that is a trivial proof. And what do you do in an induction step? Well, you fix your local variable n, you assume P of n, and then you have to show P of sub of n. And this is again by simp, but that's not the important point. So this is, if you ignore the fact that this is a special formula, this is really a blueprint for structural induction on natural numbers. You have two cases. One is P of 0, the other one is fix n, assume P of n, and show P of sub of n. And the only thing you have to do as a user is really to introduce this P here, this abbreviation, so you could refer to it inside and you didn't have to type the whole formula again. You can also, in case you wonder, why is that automatic here, that step, when you have P of n and you thus get P of sub of n? Well, if you want to do it in more detail, you can, of course, do so. Here is the complete derivation as a sequence of equations, but that's neither here nor there, so I'm not going into this. Let's, in fact, remove this for a moment. And let's compare just like for the case distinction, for the induction, two styles of doing an induction. Let me... Yep, now we see both of them. Okay, can't quite. Never mind. So up there is the proof that we just saw, where you explicitly, where you don't have to retype the whole formula, but you have to introduce this abbreviation, and then you show, you give that formula there, you give a formula what you assume, and you have to essentially in some way type in the formulas that you're assuming and proving. Here is the implicit format that follows this case idiom. So see the difference. Here we write assume explicitly, but here we just say case successor of n or case zero. And that sets up everything that we did by hand up there, like assume p of n is done just by writing case successor of n. So that implicitly introduces this n here, because you wrote n, and assumes the thing that you're trying to prove for the variable n. And now it does even more. If you look here, then it says thus question mark case. So this question mark case is also system generated. And it says, well, I'm not using thesis again, because in an induction, in every case, you have to prove something different. Here you get the something different by explicitly saying P of n or P of zero or P of suck of n. Here you don't even have to do that. You just write case, and the system will know, oh, you're in the case successor. So what you have to prove is this formula here, where n has been replaced by successor of n. So in the end, you should just view this as an abbreviation of this here without the need to introduce the P by hand. That is all done behind the scenes by just the induction method. Question? Then let's step back and look at it on the slide. I don't understand this. So this is the implicit way of doing it with the case construction. So you say show some proposition P of n, induction on n, case zero, show case, case suck of n, show case. And in both cases, well, in particular in this case, in here, you can use two things. You can use the variable name n, and you can use the label name suck, and suck will stand for whatever assumptions you are given here. So this is what happens behind the scenes. If you say case zero, it says, we're in the case zero. That means the thing that I have to prove here is P of zero. So the system will automatically generate the right instance of the theorem that you're trying to prove. And here it'll do a bit more. It'll introduce this n, it'll assume P of n, and it will give that assumption the name suck. And it'll also introduce the abbreviation down here, that in the case that we're currently in, we have to prove P of suck of n. So here you can see there's quite a lot of abbreviation going on, and so this is really a lot more compact than writing all of this out by hand. So that's why this is I prefer this style. Yeah.
So how does this assume suck differ from the because you can also use the suck by h, right?
I'll get onto that in a moment. Now, it gets a little bit more complicated when you the thing that you're trying to prove is an implication itself. Because then the system may do a little bit more than you expect. So you now say, okay, I want to do the induction on N, and then what do you expect is the case here that you have to prove? In if you're in case zero, what would you expect this to be? Yeah.
I would expect it to be show A of that P of zero follows from A of zero.
Right. But the fact that this is an implication, the system already simplifies things a little. So what it does here, it allows you to assume A of zero. So this here is already an assumption, namely A of zero. And what you have to prove here is just the right-hand side of the implication, the P of zero. So down here, the case is just P of zero, but up here in the assumptions, you already are given A of zero. So the system says, okay, you're trying to prove something with a double arrow for the case zero. So you're trying to prove A of zero implies P of zero. Well, you may as well just assume A of zero and then show P of zero from it. So that's what's happening here. That in correspondence to the double arrow, you have an assumption already, and you're only required to prove the thing at the end of the assumption, at the end of the arrow. And here, it therefore gets a little bit more interesting, because now we will have two assumptions. We will have one assumption that's just the normal induction hypothesis, but we will have a second assumption from the fact that we are now proving an implication. So even in the induction step, what do we have? We have here our induction hypothesis that A of n implies P of n, but then what we need to prove is that A of suck of n implies P of suck of n, and therefore the A of suck of n is already given as an assumption that you can make use of, and you're only required to prove the P of suck of n. That's the case that you have to show in the end of your proof. So that means here our suck, which is the name of the label for all the assumptions in here, stands for two things. It stands for the induction hypothesis, and it stands for the first premise, because you're proving an implication here. So those two things you can keep apart with this additional naming scheme that we get onto in a moment. So that's the one thing to keep in mind. If you prove an implicative statement, then your induction hypothesis will not just be the normal induction hypothesis, but it also be the left-hand side of the implication that you have to prove in the step case, namely the A of suck of n, and only the right-hand side is the thing that you really have to prove in the end. So that's in order to keep those two kinds apart, here the induction hypothesis and the premises that come from the fact that you have an implicative statement, in order to keep them apart, there's a bit of a naming convention. So if in general, of course, you may be proving something like this in by structural induction, and then if you're in case C, you now have a more refined naming scheme. If you write C.ih, then it really stands only for the induction hypothesis. So here, C or suck.ih would stand for the first line here, the induction step, the induction hypothesis, that for n, what you're trying to prove is already correct. So that's C.ih. And C.prems are all the assumptions A1 to AN in the step case, and then you have to prove the B. So under C.prems, you can already find A1 to AN, but of course for the step version. So it's not really AI, but it's AI for, in our case, if it's a natural induction, natural number induction, then it's AI for the successor case. And if you just write C, well, then it's the two of them together. So that's what we had on the previous slide, where under successor you get two of them together, under successor.ih you get this, under successor.trems you get this. And that just helps the reader a little bit, because what you can, of course, do, you can just write successor of in parentheses 1 and 2, and then you get the first one and the second one, but that's pretty unreadable, because reader won't remember what 1 and 2 is. But if you write suck.ih, then that's very intuitive. Oh yes, the induction hypothesis for the case that we're in. So I recommend you use that if you need to be that fine-grained. Sometimes maybe you can just prove the whole step by just throwing in all the assumptions, and it doesn't matter. You don't need to distinguish them so finely. And so I would like to, not quite conclude. First, a little remark on style, just how to choose between these different styles of writing your inductions or case analyses. The first one is, that's the standard one that the system also offers you. So similarly to the case analysis, in the induction, the system also offers you in inductions the template for writing the induction. So if you alternatively go on the output window and you look at this line, then, well, if you look at the line itself, there you see, as I explained at the very beginning of the lecture, you see the sub-goals as the system generated them. So here you can check what you actually have to prove. You can read it here, but also you see the proof outline down here that you can click on, and then it'll generate that template for you, and you just need to refine it from that. So that's quite helpful if you don't want to type so much, or you're not so familiar with it already, and the system gives you a head start, so you don't have to remember the exact syntax of the induction template. So that's the system, the compact system-supported way of doing it with a case, and then mentioning one of the constructors of the data type that you're in. And you really have to, by the way, use the ASCII names. So if you're you're doing induction on lists, you can't write case and then just open square brackets, close square brackets. You really have to write nil. And similarly for cons, you have to write cons. You can't use the syntax hash. That's just a convention. Now, this is the long form where you explicitly fix variables, assume formulas, and you show some other formulas, and you don't rely on the system abbreviations. This is, of course, easier to read for the reader because everything is there. No contextual references. You don't have to understand what exactly induction means. It's all spelled out explicitly, but it means you have to type more, and in case you want to change something, you have to change multiple formulae, because if you change something in the statement that you're trying to prove, you will have to change something in the formula here and in the formula there. So this is the more maintainable version. This is the more easy to read one, and you take the choice. Now, finally, I want to say something about computation induction in ESA. Remember, computation induction was the induction that sets up, that follows the recursion scheme of the function. And that is useful in case your function is not primitive recursive but has some unusual forms of decomposing the patterns. Then it's quite helpful to do the computation induction. And there are some hints that you should be familiar with. So, and here is a simple example. Let's see if we can get all of it on the screen? Well, not quite, but almost. Ah, yeah.
So up there is the function div2 that divides the natural number by 2, and 0 by divided by 2 is 0, 0 divided by, 1 divided by 2 is 0, and then sac of n divided by 2 is n divided by 2 plus 1. And now we want to show that 2 times div2 of n is less or equal n. And how do we do this? We are not doing a structural induction on n, because that would give us only two cases, 0 and successor, and then we would have to do further refinements. So instead, we do a rule we use in the induction. We still say induction on n, but please use the rule that is associated with the div2 function. And so if you think back of computational induction, that will give you three cases, and the three cases correspond exactly to those three equations. So one case for 0, one for sac of 0, and one for sac of n. And these two cases have no assumptions, because they're not there's no recursion here. Here there is a recursion, so you can assume what you're trying to prove for n, and now you have to prove it for successor of n. And that's exactly what happens in those three cases here. And the cases are not named, they're just numbered. So you just get, for each of these equations, you get one case, case one, case two. Those are the base cases. They are just by simplification, you can see that quite easily. Like in this step here, what is case two, where we have one. So if we substitute one for it, div two of one is zero, two times zero is zero, which is less or equal one. So everything works out. And here in the case three, now that's an example where I'm not sure we have to, but we chose to actually lay out the proof as a sequence of equations and inequations. So here we start with two times div two of sac of n. So that's the sac of n case. And then eventually we end up equality, less or equal equality. We end up with sac of n, as we should in the in what we're trying to prove. So here we're using the n explicitly, and therefore we have to say this is case three, and I'm using the variable name n. If there were multiple variables in here in this third equation, then I would have to give multiple names in the order that they occur in the equation on the left-hand side. So the principle is the same as before, except that the cases are not named after the constructors of the data type, but they are named after the number of the equation that you're currently looking at. Yeah. Questions about that much? Then let's look at a more complicated case. Complicated because we are using a kind of abbreviation facility here. So now we're looking at this one. So that's the sep function that separates a list, the elements of the list, with separator A. And this is the way it's defined. And never mind the exact details of the definition, that's not what I'm interested in. I'm just interested in the fact that the second equation will only match if the first equation does not match. So that means, in fact, the second equation stands for two equations. It stands for the equation where X is empty, and it stands for the equation where X is a singleton list. All the other, if you have at least two elements in the list, then of course the first equation will match. This means that internally the system pre-processes this set of equations, or this list of equations because it's ordered, and actually performs this disambiguation that I just outlined automatically, and then it produces these simplification rules, which you can only see if I open the output. So the system implicitly has instantiated this equation and has turned it into two equations. And this is relevant because the induction will also have three cases now. One which comes from the first equation and two cases that come from these two equations. And in general, I recommend, in order just to avoid complications, I recommend not to do what I've done here and to spell out the cases explicitly by hand. But if you prefer not to do that, then you should just know that if you now perform a proof, you will get... I now do a proof of some statement. I do induction on A axis and rule set induct. So the induction rule connected with the set function we just defined. And then we will get case one, which is the first equation. And then we will get case two underscore one and two underscore two, which are the two further equations that the system generated. And they have these funny names because this is an indication, oh, this is really a subcase of equation two, and this is a subcase of equation two. So the system generates those names to call your attention to that. And you can, again, if you click here, if you go on proof, yes, then you, this outline is shown to you. So luckily, you don't have to remember what those cases are or have to figure it out. The system tells you, but this is just, I'm mentioning it because you may be confused why these strange case names, where do they come from? And they come from the fact that you have stated an equation that as such isn't really a valid equation. It's only valid if the first equation doesn't match. And so that's why this implicitly the system has turned this into two equations and therefore also into two cases. But it's best to avoid this because then you don't get tripped up by the complication. And that is also the end. Here on the slides, you simply find again what I've already told you. Generates the templates for you and so on. The naming. Yeah, there's some trickiness with the naming. You have this case one, case two, and so on. But if you write, you can't write 1.ih. You have to enclose that in double quotes. So if you're in this situation where you do a computation induction, please remember that there are some slides that remind you of some hidden traps that you could fall into, because if this integer is by itself is a name, but you're not allowed to write integer dot and then some further name, you have to enclose that in double quotes. And same here for if you want if you're in, say, case one, then one refers to all the assumptions that you have, and so you can just index this. But if you say something like ih, and then you want to use the first induction hypothesis, because if you have multiple recursive calls, therefore you will have multiple induction hypotheses, and you want a specific one, then you have to write this, and you can't write just I dot h. Basically, it comes from this line above already. Yeah. So this is all nitty-gritty details. If you come across computation induction ESA, it may be worth referring back to those slides. And that's really the end of the ESA introduction. And I will now switch gears, but I'll give you a chance to ask any questions that may have come up while I was talking. If not, then really let's start the subject proper of the course, the functional data structures. And how do we do this? I think we want to escape. And we want to open a new file.
so now we're into part two, functional data structures, and we won't yet go into new data structures today. We will stick with lists, and we will be interested in sorting. And we will discuss these first three parts today and merge sort next time. So first, correctness. If you want to sort, what is the specification of sorting? So there's a predefined predicate sorted that takes a list over a linearly ordered type and tells you whether the list is sorted or not. And this is the definition. The empty list is certainly sorted, and the list x cons x's is sorted if and only if the tail is sorted and for all the elements y in, sorry, yeah, all the elements in the tail, all the elements y in the tail of x in here, they must be less, greater or equal than the element in the front of the list. So basically here, this must be sorted and x must be less or equal to all elements in x's. And in fact, there are multiple ways of writing this. You can write it as a recursive function, you can write it as an inductive definition, you can assume that x is less or equal all the elements in there, or maybe only the next element. And so it's taken me a couple of iterations to get the standard system predicate in the right form, and I think this is the right form. It hasn't made it into the distribution yet, so it's in one of the theories that's distributed with the course, but it's different from the standard one in the theory in your version of the distribution. September or so, we'll have a new release of the system, and then this will be really the standard predicate. So, yeah, what is specification of sorting? So this was the type of sorting. So a sort function, the result should certainly be sorted. No doubt about that. Anything else that we would expect?
Well, we have to make sure that all our elements stay in the list.
Right. Like this? Right. So we would also want that if an element occurs, that an element should occur as often in the output as it occurred in the input. And you can do that, but there's a more mathematically nicer way of doing this. And we introduce the multisets. So multisets are a predefined or library defined type. They're sort of in between lists and sets. Like sets, they are unordered. There's no order in which the elements are in a multiset. But like lists, they can be more than once in a multiset. That's why it's called a multiset. So think of it as a set where elements have a multiplicity. How often are they in the set? And the definition of this type doesn't need to concern us here. We will load it from a multiset theory in the library, but what we need is a function called mset that maps a list onto the multiset. So it basically just forgets the order of the elements in the list. And then this is the, in addition to this line, we also need this, that the multiset of the sorted list is the same as the multiset of the input list. And that tells you that every element is not just in there, but that every element that you put in also comes out, but every element that you put in comes out with the same multiplicity as you put it in. So that's the specification of sorting that we will be using. And we hardly need to know anything about this, but we need to know a little bit about it. So what is a multiset? It's a set with possibly repeated elements, and we need to know that there are a few operations that correspond to set operations. So this is the empty multiset. This addMset adds one element to a multiset, so it takes an element, a multiset over that type, and it gives you back the enriched multiset with one more element. And then we have the plus operation that is, in some sense, the union of the multisets, but the multiplicities are just added together. That's why the plus operation is used. And then we need to know about two conversion functions. One we had already seen, mset, that takes a list into a multiset. And then what is also useful is the setmset, that's the set of a multiset. So it takes a multiset and turns it into a set by forgetting the multiplicities. So I hope these operations are intuitive, but I'm happy to answer any questions on what they mean, because they might not, I might have been too fast or something. Yeah.
I have more of a back-end question. As sets are basically functions from slash a to bool, are msets basically slash a to int or to net?
To net, yes. So that's the internal representation, and that's hidden from you. That's precise. So that is another way of thinking about multisets, are functions from the elements to the natural numbers. Other intelligent questions like that? If not, then let's get on with sorting, and this is where the whole thing resides. Okay, insertion sort. Not that this is so. Insertion sort is not interesting because it's a particularly efficient sorting algorithm or particularly difficult, but it's interesting because it's a good starting point for this course. And it illustrates a number of things quite nicely. And so let's look at that directly in this theory sorting. So that's part of when I write theories slash, then that's part of the subdirectory theories that is part of the repository that you hopefully have cloned. We don't need this anymore. It's just... So we had sorted. Let's focus on insertion sort. And then there's the auxiliary function called insort. What does that do? It takes an element, we're again talking about linear orders here, and a list, and gives you back a list, and it inserts the elements in the element into the right place, assuming implicitly that the list you're given is already ordered. So the first line is easy. If you insert an element into the empty list, well, it just has to be that singleton list. And in the second line, if you insert x's into a list y cons y's, well, then there's a choice. If x is less or equal y, then you just return the list x, y, y's. And otherwise, if x is actually greater than y, well, then you know the first element of the result has to start with, it has to start with y, and then you insert the x into the rest list y's. So a very standard function for inserting an element in the right position of a sorted list. And then insertion sort is simply repeatedly inserting the first element of the list into the sorted sublist. So what you do if it's, so I sort, that's the actual insertion sort, and it takes a list over linearly ordered elements, and it gives you back a list. And in case the list is empty, well, the result is empty. And in case the list is non-empty, well, then you sort the tail recursively, and then you insert the first element into the sorted tail. So I hope that's pretty intuitive. And now let's just look at functional correctness. I'm not going to detail the proof that the multiset is maintained. That is a simple induction, and you need one lemma, namely that the insort function. Remember, insort is the auxiliary function, isort is the main function. It's easy to get confused which one is which, but you can tell it by the number of arguments. Insort is the one that inserts an element into the list, so it's the auxiliary one. And this lemma is quite straightforward. It just says if you want the multiset of things that you get after inserting the X into Xs, and then it's just the multiset of the things in Xs, and then you add the element X. So remember, add multiset is not adding two multisets, but adding an element to a multiset. And then that gives you the main theorem. So let's try something else to get our brain working. Let's prove the correctness that it's sorted. So sorted von isort von Xs. And of course, everything here is by primitive recursion. You have just, in both function definitions, you have an empty list and you have a non-empty list, empty list, non-empty list. So that's, you can just do an induction on Xs here. And then auto, unfortunately, does not prove it, and you're left over with something. And so now you should look at what is left over here in the first sub-goal after the auto and figure out what lemma we might need. Yep.
If we insert an element into an already sorted list, then the list is still sorted.
Yep. Okay, let's try and state that lemma. So we have sorted of a list Xs, and then you say insort X, Xs is also sorted. Yep. I think that looks pretty convincing. And so, and the proof should again be some induction auto, so no need for either with such simple proofs, although of course you can do it and maybe it looks a bit nicer. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite go through. So it leaves something over here. And now you have to stare at this and figure out what you may need. Why couldn't it prove that? But why should it be provable? Oh, you are perfectly... in principle, you're right. You may have to say arbitrary X. Good. Unfortunately, in this case, it doesn't really help. And why doesn't it really help? It's because if you look at the function definition, the insort here... The X stays constant. The X argument for insort never changes. So that's why you don't need this generalization. In principle, maybe you would have needed it, but here you didn't need it. So the problem is a different one. But it's good to think of this. So let me just take it out again because it clutters up the statement a little bit. So let's look at it again, what happened here. Why didn't this go through? Yeah.
Since we're doing an induction on Xs, we have much inserting into A of Xs the sorted, but A of Xs doesn't need to be sorted, right?
I think it's too complicated what you're thinking.
No, it's true. Yeah. It is sorted.
I will highlight one of the assumptions that's responsible, that should lead to the conclusion. Yeah? That what? Yeah. Because if you knew that, so it's this one in combination with this one. We know that XA is in this set. What is the set of the elements in here? Well, intuitively, it should be X together with the elements in X's. So if XA is in here, then it's either equal to X, in which case things work out, because if XA is equal to X, then we have this one because of this one, because the negation is a linear order. The negation means it's in fact A is less or equal X, so that's exactly here if in case XA is equal to X. If XA, on the other hand, is equal, is an element out of here, well, then we can use this assumption that comes from the sorted predicate, and we, for this X here, we take the XA, which we know to be in there, and then we have X is less or equal XA. So it works out, but we do need this additional property of insort. Now, I think actually Sledgehammer could prove it at that point. Why? Because we have a very related property for M set, for the multiset instead of the set. And there are known lemmas that convert between sets and multisets. So I think from this lemma here, it should be automatic. But let's see. What Sledgehammer does with it. Yeah, it actually finds the missing step. It's possible. Yes. Yes, I don't like those proofs because they're really this is not nice. This is terrible. In fact, it timed out. So that means the external prover found a proof, but Isabel was not able to replay it in finite time. And therefore, we know there should be stuff already around that does it, but it's too complicated. So then what we do is we take this lemma and first use it, modify it so it's on the set level rather than the multiset. So the set of elements in the insort is the same. And now we can use an operation called insert on sets. So set.insert. You may not need the set dot. I'm not quite sure. And let's go back to the output window. We don't need the set. I'm just putting it there to emphasize where it comes from. So that's the complete analog of the multiset lemma for the insort function. And the set.insert is a function that takes an element and inserts it into an already existing set. And so this, I think, should be doable for Sledgehammer because it now not just needs to convert between the sets and the multisets. Yep, and that, we can just choose any of them. So you can see lots of multiset lemmas and set multiset conversion lemmas are used. Who? Why doesn't it like it? Why is that? Oh, duplicate factor pluration, because I need to rename the lemma, not M set insort, but set insort. And this was junk. Right. So now that we have this lemma that the set of the insort is the inserting X into set of X's, now we can use this lemma in our main proof, in our auxiliary proof here, and add it as a simplification lemma. And now it works. And the intuitive reasoning I had already explained on the board. And now we can use the lemma that we that if something is sorted, then the insort is also sorted. So let's call that sorted insort. And if we now use that as a lemma in the main theorem that the result of insertion sort is sorted, yeah, it works. Okay, so that was just, in fact, a little warming up. We could have done this kind of proof already a couple of weeks ago, but now I want to move on to something else, namely time complexity. And this is something that we will, whenever it's feasible, because they can be quite lengthy, these proofs, we will also look at the not just the functional correctness of our algorithms, but at their complexity. And so how do we measure complexity? We will measure complexity of execution time, not space, although in principle we could do that as well, but we'll just focus on time. And of course, we can't measure the precise time it takes because that would involve knowledge about the compiler. So it'll be a very rough, abstract way of counting time. And in essence, we will be counting function calls. And this is the general idea. So if you have a function that has a certain type, then in complete analogy, you can define a timing function, which we will usually call t underscore f, and it has almost the same type, but it returns not an element of the result type, but it returns a natural number, and it returns the number of function calls that were made in order to compute the result. And then you can completely mechanically translate from a definition of a function to the definition of the timing function. So if you have such an equation, f, and this may be one, if you have multiple equations defining a function, you can do it equation by equation. If this is one of your defining equations, you get a corresponding defining equation for the t function, and here you have the right-hand side e, here you have e prime plus 1. What is e prime? E prime is the result of translating e into a timed version. So here we're translating, we're using this arrow here in an overloaded way. Here the arrow translates from a function definition to a function definition. Here the arrow translates from an expression into an expression. And so I could have called this arrow 1 and arrow 2, but I didn't want to do that. So why is this plus 1 here? So this gives you the translation of the expression into another expression that tells you how many clock ticks does it take to evaluate this expression. So then you take this on the right, you take the time it takes to evaluate the right-hand side, plus 1 to account for the function call. And now we have to figure out how do we translate expressions, individual expressions. This is the general schema. If you have a function called g of some arguments s1 to sk, how much time does it take? Well, it takes the time to evaluate all of your arguments, s1 to sk. That's the time t1 to tk, because here in your inference rule, you assume you have translated s1 into its time t1 and sk into its time tk. So you have expressions that tell you how long does it take to evaluate s1 up to sk. So you first evaluate the argument, you sum up the time for that, and then you also need the time for the function call of g. So that's the time for g applied to these elements, to these arguments s1 to sk. So it's a completely compositional translation that first translates the subterms into their time, adds them up, and adds the time for the top level function call to it. Now, we simplify our lives a little bit If you get down to variables, we say variables don't take any time to evaluate. Of course, you may have to get them from the from memory, but we ignore that. And constants also don't take any time to evaluate. So any variable, if you translate it to its time, it's a zero. And constructor calls and primitive operations and on bool and numbers cost one. That's again some approximation that we make. These are very different things. Constructor calls typically require an allocation of a bit of memory on the heap. We assume that just takes one time unit. Primitive operations on bool can be very fast. Of course, operations on numbers, if the numbers get too big, then the cost one is no longer justified, because then they will actually be big integers or big natural numbers, and then they may require more than one register. But we assume that our values don't get so big that this has any effect. So we just have a unit cost model. Everything has the cost one that is kind of primitive. Here's an example. So here is one equation from the definition of the append function, which I've just called app. So the append of empty list and y's is just y's. How do we translate that into a time? So the translation I claim is this. So t app for empty list and y's is 0 plus 1. Where does the 0 come from? Well, let's go back to the definition. We're now in this situation here. We're translating a function equation. So the t of app is the time it takes to evaluate the left-hand side, sorry, the right-hand side, e prime, which, so that's the result of this translation, plus 1. So that's exactly what we have here. The plus 1 is the function call. The 0 is the time to evaluate the right-hand side. Why? Because the right-hand side is a variable, which why we have the convention of assuming to be 0. How about this one? A little bit more complicated. Append, here's the cons case. On the right-hand side, we have a cons, and then the recursive call appending the x's to the y's. And now it becomes a bit more lengthy. So the time it takes to append these two lists here is first, well, first we have to evaluate the arguments of the top-level call. What is the top-level call? That's an append, that's a cons. And it has two arguments, the x, that's the 0, and this app, that's the time it takes to evaluate the app. Then the plus 1 comes from the fact that we do have a unit time for the constructors, the cons here, and the second plus 1 comes from the fact that we have a function call, so we have the top-level equation. So then let's look inside, where does this come from? That should be the time to evaluate this. Well, it's the time to evaluate its arguments. Both of them are variables, so they take no time to evaluate. And then it's the time to actually recursively call the application operator on the two arguments here. So that's what it is. Now, if you find this a bit complicated, here is a simpler version of this formulation, how to translate an expression into the time expression for the time to evaluate it. And that is like this. T is simply the sum of all the time function calls applied to sub-expressions of E. So if you have somewhere in your big expression E, you have, you go through your big expression E, and for every sub-expression G of S1 to Sn, you say, well, every sub-expression must be evaluated, so we just sum up all the times it takes to evaluate that sub-expression, and that's just the time to call G with those arguments S1. Oh, that should be Sk, I guess. I have to correct this. Or this should be Sn. So you simply just syntactically look at each function call and sum up all the times for all the function calls. And that is the same thing as what we did. We did it sort of structurally recursively by going into the subterms one by one. Here you just look at the whole term and you globally sum up all the subterms. And then, of course, if the G is a constructor or a predefined function of Boolean numbers, then this just collapses down to zero, one. Sorry. Now, this isn't quite correct, this version here, because it assumes that really everything is being evaluated. But if you have an if or a case, you know pretty well that not everything is being evaluated. So far, we really had a pure call by value semantics. Every function would call, first evaluate all of its arguments, but a function like if then else doesn't do that. It just evaluates the first one first and then decides which ones to reevaluate. And so if you have conditionals and case expressions, they are lazy, and therefore they, if you model their timing behavior, you have to be a bit more fine-grained. And so then you would translate them like this. If you want to say, if you want to find out what's the time it takes to evaluate an if then else, well, here are the assumptions. You can translate the Boolean condition into a time information and the then and the else also into time informations T1 and T2 corresponding to S1 and S2. And then the time it takes to evaluate this is the time it takes to evaluate the Boolean condition B. That's what the where the T comes from, plus the time. Well, and now it depends. If it's B, then the time T1, else the time T2. So you're reflecting if then else with if then else, but now on the time level. And similarly for case. I'm not going to write that down. So that's something you have to keep in mind when you translate by hand functions into the timing equivalent, and you have these if then else's in there. Now, we're not interested in really exactly the sum of all the ticks, but big O is enough. And so what we allow ourselves is to reduce additive constants to one. If you look back at the original definition of the timing function for append, let's go back there. Here, that was the original one that we derived by just blindly applying the rules. And here you see, well, these zeros just disappear. So it's really this one plus two, and we allow ourselves the simplification and write plus one. Because in big O, it doesn't make any difference. Now, of course, in principle, you could automate the definition of T of F from F. I thought of doing it, but I think it's actually instructive to do it yourself and not have something magic happen. And so that's why I didn't automate it. The other reason why I didn't automate it is that only half the time do we want to apply this rather strict way of translating things. In the rest of the time, we will often say, oh, we don't count everything. We just count the number of comparisons, or we just count the number of allocations of heap elements or something. And then it's, again, not something you can automate that easily, but you have to do it by inspection, and therefore I haven't automated that. And in principle, you could prove the correctness of the timing function with respect to some semantics of the function f, if we had such a semantics, but that's an orthogonal consideration that goes into the into programming language semantics. So here we just assume this is a reasonable definition, and we can perform these definitions by hand, and we're not worried about their correctness. We just believe we're going to do that right. And precise complexity bounds, anyway, would need a much more precise model of not just the compiler, but also the hardware and maybe the operating system. So this is all very approximate. And now I want to conclude today with looking at insertion sort complexity. And here I show you in parallel, we don't need the line below, in parallel two things above, just for comparison purposes, I have again copied the definition of insort, and below is the T-insort definition, and here in the base case, which is here, it's just one, because you just have one call to the constructor, and here you have, well, you start with an if then else, you have the same if then else, and then in the then case, why is that zero? Right. Now in principle, this should be, how much should this cost us? Yep.
Two.
But since we anyway have a plus one here, because for the function call, therefore I have taken the liberty of making it zero, so I've basically shrunk the additive constant down to so that it stays one again. And here that is, of course, again the time for this insertion, and plus the one, but again I've dropped the one because we have a plus one here anyway. So there's where I'm using common sense and reduce it to a simplistic model rather than getting all the constants exactly right. And down here we have the other one, the insertion sort, the top-level function. So here we have in the base case, there we have one because we have at least one function call. And here, here we have a compound term. So here we have, in the corresponding timeline, we have the time it takes to evaluate this. So this is Ti sort of x's, plus now the time for this function call, the outer one, namely the time of insort applied to x, but of course still applied to this term I sort of x's, and then plus one for the function call. So now let's just do the top level proof of the complexity of the insertion sort function. So the claim is so that should be something you are familiar with from your undergraduate days. What's the complexity of insertion sort? Yeah, where n is the length of this, so it's length of x's squared. Now, it turns out you have to add 1 to it, but yeah. Because otherwise, if you take the empty list, you work with 0, but you still have at least one time unit, so that's why we add 1 to it. Okay, that looks reasonable. Now let's try and do that proof by induction, of course, on x's, because the insort function, the isort function, is defined by recursion on x's. So, proof by induction on x's, and then we have the case. Well, let's call it again x. Well, I couldn't write this in ESA. I would have to write cons x x's, but let's now relax this a bit. So we're in this case, and let's start from the right hand side, from the left hand side.
Well, here's exactly the defining line for that. So this is T I sort for the recursive call for X's plus, and then I just have to copy that T again, in, no, T in sort of X and I sort of X's plus one. So, how do we continue? What's the thing we can do immediately?
We can use an indeterminate hypothesis.
Yeah, exactly. So we can replace this by the length, exactly that left hand side here. Plus, well, I'm not going to copy that down again. And now, of course, we do have to look at this. And I don't want to derive it formally, so let's just let our intuition tell us something. What do you think should be the time for inserting X into X's, either exactly or some upper bound? Yeah, plus one, it happens. Yeah, but, and of course it's lesser equal because it might be much faster. Mm-hmm. At least I hope that's the right one. Let me... Yeah, that's exactly it. Okay, so we can use this. What's the length of this? Well, that's an easy lemma that I sort, the length of the result of I sort is the same as the length of the input. Here it's just the length of X's. So that means this is less or equal length of X's plus 1 squared plus, now this is the length of this, which is the length of X's plus 1. And then it so happens, if you now take the, it's already there. Sorry about that. So now we get to the right-hand side of our inequation, and I'm claiming this is actually the length of X cons x's plus 1 squared. Why is this? Well, we can exactly say what that is, because that is the length of x's plus 2 squared, so that should be the length of x's squared plus 4 times the length of x's? Or 2 times? 4 times the length. Plus 4. Yep. Okay, and if you do this, then you also get an x that squared, and you get 2 times that, plus that one is 3 times, well, you have 4 times, and you get just 1, I guess, and 1 and 1, that's 3, but you have 4, so everything is fine. Right. And that was a simple blackboard proof, which you can more or less identically write down in ESA. Here is the same ESA text using lemmas like that one that we have just speculated and using things about the length of the result of insertion sort. So In principle, there's really nothing unusual here. You just have to do your inductions in ESA, and you have to do your chain of equations and inequations in ESA. But otherwise, the principle looks like a well-structured textbook proof. And this brings me to the end of today's lecture. Any questions about what we did today? Well, in that case, that's it. And next week we will continue with sorting and then start on search trees. Thank you. Oh, and enjoy your holidays.